We are doing Pirkei Avot in the Jewish home, and we were up to the second chapter, the ninth Mishnah. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai had turned to his students and asked them to find a good path that one should stick to, and he ultimately sided with Rabbi Elazar ben Aruch, who said a good heart. And on Thursday night, we explored another understanding of a good heart. And then he asked them, "Se'u ure'u, go out and see. Ezo yiderech ra'a sheitrachek mimena ha'adam. What is a bad path that a person should distance himself from?" Now, you would think that that's pretty obvious. Look at the opposite of what you said earlier, the good path. Distance yourself from that, and you get to the good path. So, we have to know that there are good traits, that the opposite of them is not bad. If a person is extra pious, so the opposite of that, he's not extra pious. Okay, that's not bad. You could be a chassid, you could forgo and give more than you owe, and then you could say, no, I'm going to give exactly what I owe. You're not bad. You're doing within the call of duty. So that's why when they said a good eye, so the first student comes back and says, Rabbi Eliezer says, Ein ra'a. A person might say, if I have a bad eye, I don't want to give anyone what's mine. What's wrong? I'm respecting what's theirs. All I'm asking is that they respect what's mine. Comes Rabbi Eliezer and tells us, no, it's not so. The idea of being stingy, of not wanting to give, is really bad. You'll say, but I'm not taking anything from anyone. I'm just not giving what's mine. And Chazal said, no, that's bad. What were the Sodom and Amorah doing? They were intent on you not having from what's mine. The Sodomites and the Amorites. So they made all these laws to ensure that no one would ever want to visit their town. But at the end of the day, what was their focus? Their focus was just leaving what's mine. I don't want to have anything to do with you. I'm good on my own. I don't want to help you. You don't help me, and I'm fine. So we have to know that that is, according to Rabbi Eliezer, that is the root of all bad. You want to know what to distance yourself from? It's an attitude that says, I just don't want to give you what's mine. Let you have what's yours, and let me have what's mine, and that's it. And the truth is that he's giving us a tremendous insight here. Think for a moment. Why would a person say, you have what's yours and I'll have what's mine? What lies behind that statement? I'm confident that I'm never going to need you. Because if I really thought I needed you, then I would treat you differently, right? One of the challenges in marriage is when people are financially well off. There's a greater tendency for divorce when the economy is doing well. Because people feel like, I can manage without her, she could manage without me. If I know that I need her to watch the kids, and I need her, and there's no way I could manage if we weren't together, if I need her income, she needs my income, we both know we can't manage, then suddenly we have reason to make it work. There was once a couple that came to the rabbi, and the wife was intent on getting a divorce. The husband was a multimillionaire. So the rabbi understood the winds that were brewing, and he said to her, okay, we're going to take care of the divorce tomorrow, but I want you to know, we're going to ensure that you get $3,000 a month to cover the rent and the kids' food, and everything else is staying with him. So she was like, huh? What do you mean? So he said, look, you don't need more than that to manage. You'll be fine. You'll live. You'll have food. But the wealth is staying with him. There's no reason you should get any of it. They're still happily married today. Suddenly wasn't so happily. Yeah, they worked it out. You know what? When you don't think that you're going to end up with he's going to have $50 million, she's going to have $50 million, suddenly it's not so appealing to get divorced. So you know what? You could bridge your differences. Part of the reason that people don't bridge their differences is because there's no reason to. Why should I? I can manage without you. You need me, like one husband told me. I'm the one that has all the friends in society. Everyone likes me. If I leave her tomorrow, she's all alone. Well, she needs me. I don't need her. Well, that's a lie. It's not true. Anyone who tries divorce learns it the hard way. It's not that way. But one of the greatest faults and one of the greatest hardships that men have within marriage is lack of appreciation. Starting from Adam, who looked at Eve and said, without her I was doing just fine, God. I didn't sin before she came to the scene. She gave me the forbidden fruit. That was the first thing Adam said. God comes to him and says, what'd you do? And Adam says, hey, wait a second. What'd you give me this woman for? You wanted me to have faith in her. You wanted me to consult with her. She told me to eat the fruits. Well, if I only listen to her when I think she's right, then I don't have a good consultant. Obviously, you want me to listen to her when I'm not sure she's right. So I did. I did what you wanted. And look at what got me, God. So that Adam doesn't have appreciation for the gift that God gave him. And that I think that that's every person in their own marriage relives that situation. Where he looks at his wife and he says, I can manage just fine without her. This is especially poignant in the first 2-3 years of marriage. To quote a young chatan, he once told me, I know you're not supposed to talk about divorce. I would never talk about divorce. But I got to tell you, if she'll want divorce, I won't say no. But very often that's the feeling that men have. And we have to know that to a great extent it stems from Ayin Ra'a. That feeling that I don't need her. And the earlier it is in the marriage, the more a person is apt to feel that. The later it is in the marriage, the more you start realizing, wait a second, this is the mother of my kids, like the Gemara says. But the truth is that on every level, when you build a relationship, so one has to have an ayin tova, one has to want to give, and one has to want the other one to have it good as well. And that's not easy. So Rabbi Eliezer says, if you want to know the one trait you should stay away from, it's a bad eye. It's a feeling of, I just don't want to give him what's mine. So we have to work on the antithesis of that, and we have to know that that attitude is problematic. And according to Rabbi Eliezer, it is the root of all evils. The root of all evils is that kind of attitude. The Talmud tells us that Jerusalem was destroyed. Why? Because people maintained justice. There were fear, but they stuck to the letter of the law. If I don't owe you more than this, why should I give you more than this? Marriage is the antithesis of that. Marriage is the ability to say, he was wrong or she was wrong, and even though they were wrong, I'm going to go with them on this. And the Gemara tells us the Torah is chesed from beginning to end. Familiar with the Medrash? Medrash says the Torah begins with chesed and ends with chesed. How does the Torah begin with chesed? Adam and Eve are in need of clothing. God makes them clothing. How does the Torah conclude with chesed? Moshe is in need of a burial plot and God buries him. So one of my teachers, Rabbi Avraham Ort, once pointed out to me, he said, wouldn't you say the first chesed in the Torah is creation? Or after that, Adam needs a wife, God makes him a wife? That's not chesed. Chesed is when Adam needs clothing and God makes him clothing. What about everything else in creation? God made food, God made plants, God made everything else in creation. That's not chesed. Why did our sages see fit to tell us that chesed begins with making clothing for Adam? So he said, I think, a phenomenal insight. He said, if you want to know what chesed is about a situation where the other side did something wrong, and now the question is, who's going to carry the weight of what they did wrong? When Adam eats from the forbidden fruit, so then the most natural response is, hey Adam, you ate, I told you not to eat. So now you feel naked, go make your own clothes. When God does something, even though Adam doesn't deserve it, so to speak, he brought this problem on himself. And then God does something for him to fix the problem that Adam himself made, that's chesed. You want to know where the Torah begins with chesed? Of course there's chesed in creation. All of creation is about chesed. But you want to see chesed in its true light, you have to see it when the other side doesn't deserve it. And that's what we have to work on when he says, distance yourself from Ayin Ra'a. Ayin Ra'a says, you bake this cake, you eat it. You burnt the food, why should I eat it? You burnt the toast, you eat the burnt toast, I'll make myself a good piece of toast. And you'll be surprised how often it works that way. I've told you 10 times you shouldn't run without gas. So today you got stuck on the highway, go call AAA. No, Go put on your boots, go out there and bring her a jerrycan of gasoline. Ah, you're tired. Why should you have to pay the price for something you told her 10 times not to do? Right, that's what marriage is all about. Marriage is all about, I told you not to. Marriage is about not saying that I told you so. It's antithesis of ayin ra'ah. It's the, I want to do good. And I'm not going to sit here and be judgmental. Well, it's her cake, let her eat it. She did this to herself. Yes. I think in general it doesn't exist. She knows better than you what it feels like to be stuck out there without gas. You're saying it is, I don't think that's what's going to make the difference. And not only will it not make the difference, it will make her feel that you don't love her. Because why, the feeling is, why did you have to say it? Which brings us to a whole other discussion, which is, anytime you say a word of criticism, the message you're giving is, this word of criticism was more important for me to tell you than your feelings, than the fact that I hurt your feelings. So that's what you're saying. That's how it's going to be interpreted. And believe it or not, that's how men interpret it too. Men will word it differently and women will word it differently. But at the end of the day, when either side within a marriage criticizes, the message that's being received is not only the criticism, but also that word of criticism was more important to you than my feelings. So it better be legitimate, and you better be prepared to suffer the consequences for that feeling of this criticism was more important than my feelings, because there will be consequences. Or in Rav Simcha Cohen's words, the glue of marriage is compliments, and the severing of marriage is criticism. So every time you have to think 10 times, was it worth it? Because what you're basically doing is you're distancing your spouse. And I think the message usually hits home, and not only that, more often than not, we have to ask ourselves, is the criticism because of the constructiveness that I'd like, or is it really me venting what I'd like to say? And 90 times out of 100, it's more what I want to say than what the other side has to hear. Proof of the pudding, if it were really what the other side had to hear, I think when was the best time to say it? Which is not when they're sitting out there in the freezing cold waiting for the guests. Okay, and then the question is there a better way to say it? And does it really need to be said? Or could we achieve the same effect without it? Or maybe it's my job to fill up the gas every morning or every time it's necessary. And maybe that's just something I'm going to have to forego. Like that couple where the husband asked, every night she leaves the milk out and it gets spoiled. And I said, you tried already for 3 years, it didn't work. So get the hint, your job is to buy a new bag of milk every morning. If you're not going to be up to put away the milk, so give up on it. That's it. We're human beings. So you could lecture me from today until tomorrow that she's wrong. But you know what? Let's do the math. 365 days a year. Let's skip Shabbos. Let's assume you're buying one for Shabbos too. 365 times 4 shekel. What is that? 1,300 shekel approximately. 1,500 shekel. 4 visits to the shrink's office. You can handle it. Better than going to a counselor, okay? Believe me, making an issue over this could end you up in the marriage counselor's office. 4 visits, and that's a cheap marriage counselor. Take an expensive one, 2.5 visits. Come on, it's cheap. So what's the big deal? You buy the milk, and she doesn't always forget it out. Okay, so you swallow it. We're all imperfect. So maybe one of the points you're going to have to swallow is that she forgets to fill the gas, and once every 2-3 years, you actually have to go out there and bring her a jerrycan of gas. Yes, it's part of married life. Believe me. They live with many more imperfections of ours. Guaranteed. Guaranteed. But they swallow it better than we do. So we don't hear about it as much.
So in terms of letting
it fill the tank of gas, that's probably more practical. Most of us know that when we face Yom Kippur, we're still facing the same challenges we faced last year and the year before. On some level. So we haven't succeeded in changing much about ourselves in this lifetime. Why do we think someone else will succeed in changing theirs? It's just being realistic. Theoretically, is there a way to overcome it? Yeah, if you could really think of what's at the root of her not filling the gas, if you really understand where it's coming from on her end, then maybe you could figure out practically how to fix it. But just lecturing her about how she could get stuck in a very bad neighborhood, and she never knows what time of night, and she never knows if she'll be able to contact you, and she never knows that's probably not going to solve it if it hasn't solved it this far. And a tank of gas is a small example. People are contending with much, much bigger examples, such as the husband whose wife was on bed rest, and there was a baby at risk, and he couldn't figure out how to get her to take her forced bed rest seriously. And then she gave birth the first time. And then he's coming up to the second pregnancy and he's asking, now what? That's a real question, right? That's not a tank of gas. Okay, this is what people have to contend with. This is life. Our imperfections and our shortcomings are a real part of life. And they come up in real situations. So you tell your wife, please don't give the credit card number over the phone. And she forgets the second time. And then your whole credit is out the window and all your savings, and you're fighting in court because here in Israel they don't have the laws like in the United States where you're protected from identity theft. Real stories, they happen, and they're not a reason to even go to a marriage counselor. You know, if you think a marriage counselor will help you, fine, I'm not saying not to go. I'm saying that they're not a reason to break up. They're not a reason for a massive fight. There's something you have to work out, and you have to realize each of our shortcomings. I know a couple who the wife would not give the husband any money. And the husband was okay with it. I mean, they came to terms with it. He realized that anytime he had a penny in his pocket, he'd spend it. So they both came to terms that the only way to overcome this, his shortcoming, was that he would not walk around with money. So if he needed a bus, and he just finished his bus pass, and he didn't get it, he'd go and ask for change. But he was a little slow. So he would tell everyone that this was his arrangement with his wife. So he needs a loan of a few shekels to get himself home. That's how we all knew. But she was right. He was a little slow. This was his weakness. So this is how they worked it out. And you know what? It worked for them. Each couple has to figure out how to work out their issues. But they're real issues. Yeah. Okay, Rabbi Yoshua Omer. So Rabbi Yoshua, who was Rabbi Eliezer's contemporary, initially he was his host, Rabbi Yoshua ben Chananya, he says, you want to know what trait to distance yourself from? That is Chaver Ra. Being a bad neighbor, or Rabbi Yossi Omer, Shachen Ra, a bad neighbor, a bad friend or a bad neighbor. So if we had to sum up what's bad, bad friend or a bad neighbor, there's a lot to think about. What kind of friend is a person? A person should ask himself, what do I think my neighbors are saying about me? But my neighbor, he's a nudnik. What about your other neighbor? What reputation do you think you have among your neighbors? Chazal say, you want to know what type of person a person is? Find out what ma habriyot omrim alav. What do people say about this person? It's worth finding out what our reputation is. It's very interesting when people enter shiduchim, they get surprises. When they suddenly hear how people are describing them. I remember I was once in the Beis Medrash and a guy came over to me and he said that someone was looking for you. So he points out who's looking for me. I go over to the guy and the guy tells me who's looking for him. It's not me. So I go back to the guy who sent him to me and I said, why'd you think it was me? So he said, he said he was looking for someone like this and like that and like that and like that. I was like, that's interesting. I never thought of myself like that. He said, well, an American accent and this and that and that. He described the whole personality, which was not the way I viewed myself, but it was an eye-opener to see how does someone else view me. Chazal tell us, see, ma habriyot omrot alav. What do people say about a person? And when Rabbi Yeshua wants to encapsulize the idea of being a good person, he says, what trait should you distance yourself from? Being a bad friend. So if we were learning this mission in depth, I would say, let's make a list. What traits do you think are included in being a bad friend or a bad neighbor? We already learned what being a good neighbor is about. What's being a bad friend like? Someone tells us something and we don't keep a secret. That would probably be a bad friend. Well, how are we faring on that one? What else would a bad friend do? Maybe he would speak badly about his friend behind their back. How are we faring on that one? person has to start thinking, wait a second, what does this mean, not to be a bad friend? A bad neighbor, along the same lines, but maybe slightly different vein. Rabbi Shimon says, you want to know which trait to distance yourself from? That's halove ve'inom shalem. Someone who borrows but doesn't pay. Echad aloveh min ha'adam keloveh min ha'makom. Doesn't matter if you borrow from God or your fellow man, as the verse says, "Shneimar lo ve'rashav lo yishalem, v'tzadik chonen medonotin." The hallmark of a wicked person is that he borrows and does not pay back. So what did he say? What was Reb Shimon's good trait to stick to? Someone who envisages the future. Someone who sees ha'oet anolad. So what's the opposite of that? Someone who takes a loan but doesn't pay back. Because why don't you pay back? Because you figure I have what to gain today. If you think long term, then you'd realize that you're ruining your reputation and there's going to be payback in the long run. On Sundays, I get to sit in a Beis Horah where people come in with questions and the rabbi answers, and I apprentice there. So I get to learn from the questions and answers that come in. So one week, a man walks in and he has a question. He says, "Rabbis, you recommended this in the school for my son, and now my son has this Rebbe, and I'm not pleased with the Rebbe." And he starts listing his grievances. So I'm a youngster, I'm sitting there, I'm listening, and I think he has a point. But I'm quiet. I want to hear what they have to say. I'm there to learn, right? I'm not there to talk. So they answer him, they say, "Number one, you're forgetting a clause we told you when we recommended the school. We told you won't find the perfect school. And every school you send to, you're going to find grievances. So welcome, good morning. You found grievances. Number two, you have to have patience. It's the beginning of the year. We have to see. We're not telling you to wait till your son is burnt badly. We're not saying just be quiet and let things take their course. But on the other hand, 3 weeks into the year is not exactly a time to react yet. You haven't described anything that deserves a reaction right away. And thirdly, let's ask ourselves, where is this headed? Where are things now? Where are they headed? And how can we change that?" And when I heard his description of his grievances, I heard a Rebbe who I wouldn't want my son learning by. What I heard was a person who was trying to teach the kids out of fear. I don't think that's the way to teach kids. So I automatically pictured, I said, okay, if we take grievance number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, put them together, okay, we subtract a little bit because he's the parent, he's taking it too hard, but at the end of the day, we have a problem with the personality. So I'm sitting there thinking, how can you help this person? He shouldn't be in education. What are you going to do to help him? What did they tell him? They said, "Why don't you come to the Rebbe and tell him, you know, my son, maybe he needs a little bit more warmth. Maybe you could focus on, I see that he needs to be more excited. He used to be excited. And now maybe there's a way we can focus on making it a more positive experience this year for the boy." Meaning, sometimes you see a problem and you say, wait, where is this going to lead me? And because you're so focused on this point, let me see where things are headed. So that can become a weakness. And sometimes you have to stop and say to yourself, wait, but how can I circumvent the problem? Let me look into the future and see how I could circumvent it. What difference does it make if he's warm to the child because he knows how to be a good educator and he's going to be warm to the kid? Or it's he's warm to the child because someone gave him the tip, this kid needs your warmth. At the end of the day, did we reach the same conclusion? Did we get to the same place? Imagine the husband whose wife wasn't putting the milk back in the fridge. Now, if he'd think three steps down, and he'd realize, if I'm going to make an issue over this, we're going to end up in therapy, and I'm going to pay much more than a bag of milk would cost me. That's one attitude. But let's try to think of a better attitude. Let's say he'd take a note, and he'd write on the note, "Honey, I love you," and put a little Hershey Kiss on it in the fridge, so that when she goes to put that ice cream, that milk container back in the fridge, she sees it there. And the next morning when she forgets, he doesn't say it like accusingly. He leaves it for her to discover later. Wouldn't that be a better way? Meaning, if we can find ways of looking into the future and saying, okay, what's going to be the price? And what's going to be a positive way to achieve the same solution? So I didn't get to the point where she understands that it's a waste of milk to leave it out of the fridge. That's true. But is that what's important? The guy who borrows and doesn't pay, when I tell him, you know, you're not seeing into the future, you're not seeing the results of your actions, I could say I'm missing the point. The guy should understand that it's indecent not to pay. But that's not what we're being told here. We're being told the problem is that he doesn't see into the future. Let him first get to a point where he's doing what's right. Not for the correct purpose. I don't care. He's not doing it because he realizes a decent human being pays back what he borrows. But he allows himself to do it because he doesn't see the price for what he's going to do. Right? He doesn't see the result of his actions. So our first goal in life, very often, in education and in relationships, should be to achieve the practical outcome that I need. I don't have to make a cataclysmic difference in this guy's attitude in life. Very often people are very intent in marriage. Let her understand. Why can't she understand that? Who said she has to understand? Is your goal to get her to understand, or is your goal to reach a certain solution? Is my goal to get this Rebbe to change because I think his attitude is teaching the kids out of fear? Well, I don't see how I could get a man to change. Why should he listen to me? What advice can I give this parent who's coming in here when I see a problem in the general attitude of this Rebbe? I didn't see a solution. They came and they said, no, we need a practical solution to get a different behavior here. I don't need to change his attitude. Let me change his behavior. Whether I'll get his attitude to change over time or I won't get it to change over time, that's a different question. That's the Hanhola's responsibility. That's other people's responsibility. I need to solve this individual's problem with his child. Maybe other kids aren't reacting this way to this teacher. And this is a key point sometimes. Sometimes we're so intent on resolving the issue at the root, at the core. Who said we'll ever succeed at that? And the same applies to ourselves. So Rabbi Shimon says, if you're not being practical, you want to know what's a bad trait? A person who takes loans and doesn't pay back, because a person isn't even thinking of being honest with the other person and he doesn't realize the price he will pay. Very often in life, the person who pays the greatest price for their behavior is themselves. Last week, I was with a group of young men. We had an open session, question and answer. So, not here. So they asked me a question about this guy. I think he's called Mr. Universe or something. A guy who underwent the transplant to switch himself from man to woman or woman to man. I don't know exactly the details. So they wanted to know halachically, could he do birchas kohanim? And all kinds of halachic questions. Like, is he a man? Is he a woman? Is he this? Is he that? Okay, so after a long discussion, which you guys could pick up online in the question answer, Hebrew question answer section, it was all in Hebrew. I said to them, guys, you know, but at the end of the day, you have to pity this guy. Poor guy.
Why?
Because he's the most miserable. A person who can't come to terms with what he himself is, and then he's trying to change, and he's still not going to come to terms with what he is. He's living a whacked out life. I mean, you feel bad for a person. Very often in life, the person who pays the heaviest price for a person's behavior or a person's attitude is the person themselves. Haloveve nom shalem. A guy takes a loan and he doesn't pay back. Who pays the heftiest price in the end? It's the guy himself. I mean, it depends. I mean, if you lent all of your life savings to your brother-in-law and then he doesn't pay you back, maybe you're also paying a hefty price. But he's paying. And Rabbi Shimon says that if you want to know the formula for life, what you should distance yourself from, it's an attitude of, let me take now and let me not think of the consequences in the future. And maybe if we look at the economics all over the world today, we understand a deeper understanding of what Rabbi Shimon's talking about. We live in a time where there's no responsibility. Governments are not acting responsibly. Look at the governments of the world, the amounts of loans, the debt. I know that governments require debt to grow. I know the economic theory that you can't grow without a certain amount of debt. No, obviously there's a certain amount of debt. You can't buy a house without a mortgage. There's a certain amount of debt that's healthy. But no one would argue that the amount of debt that governments have gotten themselves into is healthy. I don't think anyone rational would argue that. The people aren't thinking it's rational. But then there's the question, where are we thinking? What are we thinking about? Is our focus on today, on tomorrow, on the long term? Where are we focused on? Rabbi Elazar says, you want to know what's the all-encompassing bad trait to distance yourself from? That's lev ra, a bad heart. And here we could apply everything we saw last time. His words encompass yours. It all revolves around where one's heart lies. Everything else stems from there. And we had mentioned on Thursday night that a good heart and a bad heart can also be understood to mean whether one wants to volunteer, to give. It all revolves around the desire to give. And everything else revolves around that desire. That was one understanding. Another one was patience, right? Okay, so that's our Mishnah today. We saw about a bad eye, and that a person, the attitude of just leave me with what's mine can be the most destructive attitude. We saw about a bad friend, and we said that that's something a person should think about. What would a bad friend do? And how can I focus on not being a bad friend? We saw about a bad neighbor, which is along the same lines, taking a loan without the intent of paying. And from there we went off on a expansion of that, that sometimes we don't have to try to fix things at the core, but quite the contrary. We have to be practical and fix things on the ground, fix things as we see them. And we said a practical application of leaving a positive note to strengthen the positive as opposed to reacting to the negative. And then the final line was Rabbi Elazar, that a bad heart, that it all revolves around where our focus is. And on this point of a bad heart, I want to expand just on one point which we've discussed in the past. Being kind, or the opposite of that, very often depends on our attitude. And very often there are external circumstances that direct our attitude, that cause us to have a certain attitude. A guy just lost his job. He walks through the door, and his son says, "Dad, I want a piggyback ride." His first reaction is, "Leave me alone," right? We have to know, Chazal told us this, and I just came across in Dale Carnegie's book, he quotes a psychologist that says this line. It's nice to see that psychology picked up on something that Chazal taught us a few thousand years ago, that if you want to change your attitude, you can work from outward inward. Meaning a person says, "What do you want from me?" That's the type of person I am. I'm annoyed, I'm upset, I don't feel like giving anyone. So Chazal told us the way to acquire a trait is by acting as though you have it. Smile and smile and smile, and eventually you will be happy. Talk patiently, talk calmly, talk patiently and calmly, and eventually you will be patient and calm. Sometimes people think, let out your anger, go scream and yell. Chazal said it's the other way around. The more you scream, the angrier you'll get. If you train yourself to behave as though you have a certain trait, then you will have it. So this key of a good heart or a bad heart, sometimes maybe it's the other way around. When I came to Israel, it struck me how many people asked me for money. So at some point I said, "Hey, these guys aren't all for real." So I stopped giving. And then it struck me how I got accustomed to not giving. So then I said, "Okay, how do I work on this?" So someone told me a plan that a rabbi once gave one of his members. He came to him and said, "My daughter has to go on shiduchim, and she's the stingiest person I ever met, and I know she won't make a good wife if she's so stingy. What can I do?" So the rabbi said, "Are you willing to invest 100 shekel in curing her?" So the man said, "Sure, I'd send her to a therapist. That would cost me 300-400 shekel a visit to cure her. Of course I'd spend 100 shekel to cure her." So the rabbi said, "Fine, go. Take a 100 shekel, transfer it into 1,000 coins of 10 agurot." Right? 10 pieces of 10 agurot is a shekel, and 100 of those is 10,000, right? 10,000. 1,000 is 10 shekel, no? 10 is a shekel, 100. No, 1,000, right, 1,000 shekel. Tell him, take 1,000 ten agurot pieces and tell her to go around town giving them out. By the time she finishes giving out to the poor, she'll give 1,000 people. She'll have to part with 1,000 ten agurot pieces. She'll be a different person. And it worked. Yeah.
Is it more beneficial to find someone that faces the same battles as you if you have a problem with leaving milk out, but find someone who also leaves the medical milk out as well? Because then you can work on putting the milk back in, so to speak, together, and then you can also understand if she leaves the milk out that, oh, I need that as well too, and I'm facing that battle as well.
Two things. Number one, I invite you to hear Thursday night's class on Shoulda Baal Tshuva Marry Baala Tshuva, where we discuss this at greater length. This past Thursday, yeah. In a question and answer session, it's under Shidduch, I think. Shidduch and Shoulda question and answer, and then the subtitle is Shidduch, Shoulda Baal Tshuva Look for Baala Tshuva. I think it depends. It depends on the point, meaning. I think in most areas we try to find someone who's very, very similar to ourselves. I don't know. It depends a little bit. So when it comes to faults, I'm not sure, meaning without a more exact example, I'm not sure. Like on the milk out, I'm not sure. Maybe it's good to compliment one another. One of them should put the milk back. You know, let's say there are areas where it's good they should compliment one another. Let's say if he can't hold on to money, she should be more tight with money. There are areas where people should compliment one another. If he's quick to make decisions, she should be more thought out. There are areas where they should compliment one another, and so it depends on the area. There are areas where they'll contradict one another, and then it's good they should both have the same attitude to life. And then there are areas where it depends on their attitude. If they can be open to the fact that they compliment one another, then it's good that they compliment one another.
So how does one, I guess, look to know what's a good area to compliment?
I don't know of one formula. I mean, in general, we look for people who are very, very similar. The more similar the couple is, the more beneficial it is for harmony. But there will be areas. There's that guy who I told you guys about. He had to get his license. So his license in his field, be it, let's say he was a lawyer. He had 2 days left to apply for the license. He wasn't going to do that either till his mother drove down to his apartment and said, "Son, where's the form? I'm filling it out for you. You're not going to lose your lawyer's license just because you're too scattered." So then he knew he needed a girl that would put his life together. She put his life together, and then one day he calls me up and says she drives me crazy. She makes an order of everything, and I say, "I don't understand. That's what you wanted. That's what you needed. Without that, you wouldn't live." You know, he wouldn't take his medication. He had a certain medication he had to take. He wouldn't take it. So by the third date, she was on to it, and she'd say, "Oh, you bring that medication to the date." And he was happy with it. You know, she saves his life. So what does he want from her? So yeah, that complimenting factor is something which will sometimes get on his nerves, but that's only because he's being stupid. So you should recognize it stems from the fact that he's being stupid. Now, it's very hard for us to say that about ourselves. I'm being stupid. It's the last thing we want to say. But the truth is, that's really what's happening there. So it depends on the area. If a person can be open to it, so then very often complimenting one another is very beneficial, if the person can be open to it. You know, and then it also depends on the chemistry. You know, a different girl would drive him crazy. Or he'd drive her crazy. He's lucky this girl's willing to put up with him. You know, what other girl who's so organized would be willing to put up with a guy who's like this? Okay, but she is, and she loves him, so he's very lucky. He has the girl that's putting his life together, and she's willing to put up with him, and she loves him. No, what's better than that? Ah, sometimes it gets on his nerves. Okay, no, that's life. But he has to be mature enough to see that. So I think it depends a little bit. It depends on our own attitude state, and I think that if we're similar in a point that isn't lethal, meaning sometimes a couple that they're both irresponsible about money. That's how you find couples who lose their house and end up being homeless, and you reach a point where who's the adult here? You know, there you have a problem. Sometimes like this guy, he needed someone who would put his life in order. Otherwise, things that would be a lethal combination, someone who had the same shortcomings as him. But in other areas, if they both have the same shortcomings, I think it can work. And I think those are the types of things which, if everything else works, okay. So sometimes we realize we both have a blind spot, so we have to be more aware of it. I'm not sure I would nix a shidduch for that. I don't think it's necessarily an asset. It might be a better asset if they complemented one another. But at the same time, if couples are very, very similar, very often they will find that they have the same blind spot. They have to be aware of it. And then they'll both work on it. And that's where it's recommended to have someone else to talk to. Sometimes you'll talk to a parent. There are issues where I would recommend get someone else's input. Because you both have the same attitude. Me and my wife are very similar. We both grew up in the same communities, literally. Mm-hmm. Meaning, we went to the same elementary school. We grew up both in Ashkenazi families where the grandmother's Polish. And you end up having certain blind spots which you share. Yeah. And then sometimes you say, wait a second, let me get a third party's opinion on this. Sometimes I feel like, wait, I know you and I see eye to eye on this, but maybe there's a problem that we both see eye to eye on this. Let's get a third opinion on this. When I was applying to a certain teaching position, so we were looking at it one way. And I said, we got to get a third opinion on this. I called Rav Listman. I spoke to him for 5 minutes. And I got a totally different angle on the whole thing. Sometimes you need that. And it's specifically when couples are very similar, so they have to realize that's an asset, but there is a certain built-in weakness. It's like a family business. People say family business is great. We all understand one another. Yeah, you all share the same blind spots. You need a stranger, someone who has a different background. So you still build a family business. But if you're smart, you still bring in someone else who won't have the same blind spot.
I never thought of that idea.
It's not my own.
I know. It sounds like a good idea.
Every idea has its pluses and minuses.